Today I'd like to speak directly to the people across the broader Middle East. My country desires peace. Extremists in your midst spread propaganda claiming that the West is engaged in a war against Islam. This propaganda is false, and its purpose is to confuse you and justify acts of terror. We respect Islam, but we will protect our people from those who pervert Islam to sow death and destruction. Our goal is to help you build a more tolerant and hopeful society that honors people of all faiths and promotes the peace.
Now, here's the question I had when I heard the president say that in his UN address yesterday in New York. At the end of that sentence, I thought to myself, can those two things go together? A respect for Islam, a high view of Islam, and a society that actually respects all religions and keeps the peace. Can Islam produce that kind of a society? Noble intentions and sentiments on the part of the president, are they realistic? Dr. Alvin Schmidt is with us for the next few minutes of the program to answer that very question about President Bush's comments to the UN yesterday on Islam. Dr. Schmidt, is the president being realistic?
Probably not. The problem is he's on the horns of a dilemma. If he doesn't say that, he would indicate that we are at war with Islam, and that would bring the rest of the world, including much of the West and maybe even a lot of our people, down on him. Or, for example, if he and the other horn of the dilemma is, for example, that we continue doing what we're doing now, is in a sense fighting with our hand behind our back and denying reality. 1,400 years of existence of Islam indicates that we are not just fighting a few radical Muslims, not at all. And when the Pope made reference the other day to a 14th century Byzantine emperor referring to Muhammad, what he did, he was right on the money, that emperor. And we saw what happened. You know, there is a tremendous amount of, I don't know what you want to call it, contradiction or whatever in our society. I'm reminded to some extent of what George Orwell said in his book 1984, where he said time would come that people would believe that 2 and 2 equals 5. We're in somewhat similar situation today relative to seeing Islam as a religion of peace, in spite of the fact when they in essence say, we are a religion of peace, and if you don't believe it, we'll kill you. We don't seem to get the message that this is a contradiction, like saying that 2 and 2 equals 5, and that's where we're at. When the president says that, I can understand why he does, and I don't know if he firmly believes that or not, or whether he feels that this is the only thing he can do politically. I don't know. But we're obviously, as I see it, doing the wrong thing in many ways. We're not recognizing who the enemy is, and by that we're not corralling our resources or fighting the enemy as we could or should.
Do you think, kind of backing to back with the statements from Ahmadinejad earlier, also in his address to the UN, he portrayed Islam as a vehicle for peace, for justice, for just societies. And in listening to his comments, I thought to myself, well, given the state of affairs in Iran today, one must wonder whether or not he's defining justice a way different from the common definition here in the West. So do you think that the thoroughgoing Shiite Muslim leader like him actually believes that justice can be achieved in a state that is dominated by Islam?
Well, yeah, justice to them as the concept of peace means to submit, which is what the word Islam means. And so his concept of justice is one where we would submit and they would have complete control over us. Well, that is not the Western or the biblical Judeo-Christian understanding of justice. But that's what he means by it. And we also have to remember, in fact, it's disappointing. And maybe, again, these guys can't do it for some reason or another. I'm talking about radio talk show hosts and others on the news media when they interview a given Muslim individual, and immediately up comes the context, the comment that it's a piece, and I never find anyone ever challenging these guys when they say it by going to the Quran. As I have mentioned in context of writing and the like, that when they say Islam is a religion of peace and commonly cite the fifth chapter, the 32nd verse of the Quran, where Islam is, you know, supposed to be tolerant of all religion, these passages have been abrogated, annulled. No one in the media ever brings that up. Either they don't know it or they don't want to. And by passages being abrogated or annulled means they're still in the Quran, but they have been overruled or annulled by more recent passages, and those are the violent passages. So the peace passages that are in the Quran, and by the way, they're precious few, are no longer valid, but they are cited again and again to the public, to the reporters, and they get away with it. And it's very, very unfortunate. If they were to cite just a few verses out of the Quran, now how do you respond to those? I never hear it, and that is a sad thing. So the propaganda is in many ways helped by the lack of our questions that our media people fail to ask and to really get to the bottom of the truth of it. They don't ask Ahmadinejad what he means by justice. They should, but they don't. They again assume. You see, oftentimes we come from the Christian perspective that we tend to think these people think like we do. They do not. You have an entirely different world view here.
All right. I have to ask you one more question, and this one goes with a subject we're going to raise a little bit later during Audio Open Lines on the Pope's comments on Islam. But I was listening to an interview in the fallout from the Pope's comments on violence in Islam. They were interviewing a very prominent Muslim scholar who is an academic here in the United States. The name escapes me. And they were reading from a New York Times editorial that said, look, even it was from a position of kind of the political left. Look, even we people on the left must admit that what happened here after the Pope's comments were over the top, and these were unprovoked attacks on churches and a nun. And the Muslim scholar, Dr. Schmidt, said, no, those attacks were not unprovoked. The Pope's words were words of violence. Therefore, the response of violence was appropriate.
Well, he's a true Muslim. He's following the Quran. He's following 1,400 years of Islamic tradition. I can't put it any other way. And this is what we in the West have a hard time believing.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. You can order this excellent book, The Great Divide, by calling 1-800-636-2470, 1-800-636-2470, or you can find out more about The Great Divide. Just go to Amazon.com. Dr. Schmidt, thank you for being our guest.
My pleasure.
Pope Benedict is reaching out to Muslims again this morning, saying his controversial remarks about Islam were misunderstood. ABC's David Wright has the latest from the Vatican. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Chris. The Vatican is clearly hoping to put this controversy behind them. At his weekly audience today, Pope Benedict tried again to assuage Muslim anger over comments he made in Germany last week by explaining he meant no offense. And Benedict took care to repeat his explanation in several languages.
I hope that my profound respect for world religions and for Muslims who worship the one God, and with him we promote peace, liberty, social justice, and moral values for the benefit of all humanity, is clear.
The Pope said he hopes the controversy can lead to a constructive dialogue among the faiths. And he may get his answer on Friday. That's when many Muslims are planning a worldwide day of nonviolent protest.
Well, there's a story from ABC News on the Pope's latest comments. These are public comments, again, made in several languages, not expressing regret or apology, but simply saying, don't misunderstand me, I have the highest respect for Islam. Now, I want to focus on his English comments here in a moment, but I'd like your reaction. This is going to go on for a long time. If the Pope keeps issuing statements here as long as the protest goes on, one will begin to wonder whether or not these statements of regret or clarification are fueling continuing protests. We'll see, I guess, what does happen on Friday. It's audio open lines for the remainder of today's program. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, if you weren't listening carefully, you might have simply heard the Pope say, look, I respect Islam, don't get me wrong. But he actually said more than that. And what he said was not picked up by the report from ABC News because it wasn't pertinent to their angle. But what he said there in English was that he respects all religions, including Islam, that worship the one God. I got no problem with the Pope saying, don't get me wrong, I respect Islam, or don't get me wrong, I respect Muslims. But even papal authority does not grant him the ability to say that Muslims, along with other religions, worship the one God. Do Muslims worship one God? Sure they do. Allah. Is it the one God? Worshipped by other religions, namely Christianity? No. Now, in this sense, he's simply following in the footsteps of his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, an admirable man in so many ways, but who simply bought in to exactly the same kind of religious pluralism that is so popular today among Catholics and non-Catholics all over the world, especially here in the United States, that all roads lead to the same God, that if you say you worship one God, it must be the one God, to use Pope Benedict XVI's terms there. And this is why no one notices or blinks an eye, because they say, sure, don't we all worship the same God? Look, if you're going to extend an olive branch to Islam, the one thing you can't compromise is the basic distinction between Islam and Christianity. To say that Muslims and Christians worship the same God, no matter how you say it, no matter how you spin it or how subtle you are in expressing it, some are not so overt as the Pope. No matter how you say it, you have completely erased the fundamental distinction between Christianity and Islam, which is, by the way, the person of Jesus Christ. Why can't we say that Muslims worship the same God that Christians do? Well, it's very simple, and it has everything to do with Jesus Christ. Christians worship God as revealed in the person and work of the God-man Jesus Christ. Muslims don't. It's a different God. This is not some sort of splitting of theological hairs. This is not some sort of odd Wilconian interpretation of Scripture. This is clear. This is Jesus himself saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. You don't get the Father apart from the Son. In fact, Paul reiterates this. He says, those who have the Son have the Father. Those who do not have the Son do not have the Father. Jesus himself also says to his own opponents in the Jewish faith, who claimed to worship the same God. In fact, they claimed to worship the God of the Old Testament as Jesus did. The God that Jesus calls his Father. And Jesus says, no, that's not your Father. Your Father is the devil. They claimed to worship the same God Moses did. And Jesus said, no, you don't. If you listened to Moses, you'd believe in me. Jesus is the dividing line. It's that simple. Now, you will hear preachers, theologians, church leaders tell you that somehow we can permit the Muslims the dignity of worshiping our God in an imperfect way. Look, it's either worshiping God as revealed in Jesus Christ, his person and work, or it's worshiping a false God. If we can't make that distinction, which apparently the Pope can't, I'm going to play that again for you to hear. I want your reaction as well. If we can't make that distinction, then there are no other distinctions that really matter in Christianity any longer. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. So while I agreed with what Pope Benedict had to say last week about Islam, he was right to make a connection between violence and Islam. He's absolutely dead wrong about Muslims and Christians worshiping the same God. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. It's Audio Open Lines this Wednesday, September the 20th. Tell me if I'm misunderstanding this. Here's the Pope again, speaking in English, in his expression, his latest expression on his comments about Islam. Listen carefully.
I hope that my profound respect for world religions and for Muslims, who worship the one God, and with him we promote peace, liberty, social justice, and moral values for the benefit of all humanity, is clear.
Am I misunderstanding this? To say that world religions and Muslims who worship the one God, to put all those things together, is to blur and destroy the distinction between Christianity and any other religion. This is a First Commandment issue. This isn't theological rocket science. This is elementary kindergarten grade stuff. When God says, "You shall have no other gods before me," he didn't say, "Oh, by the way, if you're one of the respectable monotheists in the world, say a Muslim or a Jew, fine, you worship me too, you just don't know it." No, there are no anonymous Christians. But nowadays we have the three respectable monotheisms, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And it is simply taken as conventional wisdom, taken as a self-evident truth, that if you're monotheistic, it's all the same God. Even the Pope falls prey to this. Now, he has some rather sophisticated theological reasoning behind that mistake. If you read the 1995 Catechism on the Catholic Faith, which this Pope, by the way, largely wrote himself, if you read that, you will see the sophisticated theological arguments made to try and bring Muslims into the family of the Christian faith. Not through evangelism, but just saying many of them are probably anonymous Christians. But no matter how whether your reasoning is sophisticated or it's purely out of ignorance, the conclusion is false. I want to hear from you. I mean, otherwise, here is a man I admire, especially for his backbone when it comes to standing up for what Roman Catholics believe. But here is one where we simply have to part with Pope Benedict on this issue of one God for all world religions. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Up first this afternoon during Audio Open Lines, Matt is calling from his car. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Pastor Todd. I just wanted to ask a question of clarification, and it may just be that I don't understand enough of Islam. I understood the big distinction you made about the work in person of Jesus Christ, and I agree that's a huge distinction that they tend to forget or leave out. But also, I understood that Islam also does not recognize or worship a triune God. And I was also wondering about do they recognize the person work of the Holy Spirit in their understanding of God? I was just wondering if you could answer those questions.
Well, that's a very good question. Now, the reason I say that the dividing line here is Jesus Christ, not to denigrate or not to leave aside the issue of the Trinity, but the Trinity really here is a secondary issue when it comes to answering the question, do Christians and Muslims worship the same God? You could start from the Trinity and say, well, Christians worship a triune God, that is, one God in three persons. And obviously, Muslims worship one God, no distinction of persons in that one God, different God. You can go at it that way. The problem with that is it fails to recognize that for Christianity, the Trinity hangs entirely, ultimately, upon the revelation of God in the incarnate Son of God, Jesus Christ. We don't have the full-orbed teaching of the Trinity in its fullness until we have God in human flesh dead on a cross and alive again after 3 days. In other words, it is not a belief in the Trinity that makes one a Christian. It's a belief in the incarnate crucified and risen Christ that makes one a Christian, and with that goes necessarily the teaching of the Trinity. But you're right. You can go at it the other way, and many of our guests have. Ergun Kaner, we talked with him. And when asked the question about Muslims and Christians worshiping the same God, he answered it from the vantage point of the Trinity. But you, if you can argue from the Trinity, you got to press on and say, and by the way, even apart from the issue of the Trinity, it has everything to do with the God whom Jesus Christ himself has revealed to us. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us during audio open lines. Issues ETC at KFUO.org. Tony calls from his car. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I was wondering if you have ever heard, because I haven't, a Muslim scholar anywhere say that Christians worship the same God as Muslims. I don't think I've ever heard that.
I don't think, thank you, Tony, I don't recall having personally heard a Muslim scholar make such a statement. Now, in the many guests that we've talked about on this very issue here on Issues, etc., among them, as I mentioned before, Ergun Kaner will tell you definitively, there is no thoroughgoing Muslim who would ever say anything like that. In fact, he said it many times on the air. There is no Muslim he knows of, a thoroughgoing devout Muslim who truly believes what the Quran teaches, who could ever say that they worship the same God as Christians. He says it's only, what did he call them? Oh, he had a great name. It's only, it won't come to me. It's right on the tip of my brain. It's only these mushy-headed evangelicals. He didn't use that term. He had a better one. Mushy-headed evangelicals and Christians in the United States who are all talking about everyone worships the same God. Muslims don't believe it. Now, if you find a Muslim who's willing to go to one of these interfaith religious services that they hold so often here in the United States, who's willing to stand on the dais with Christians and Jews and whatever else, Buddhists. What with the one down in Katrina, who was the guy? It was a Buddhist monk, the guy who had the prayer that just went on for 3 minutes. You find a Muslim in that context who's willing to do that or who's willing to say that, you have found yourself, at least in Ergun Kaner's judgment, someone who is not paying very close attention to what Islam teaches. Jerry calls from South County. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, hi, Todd. I noticed, too, we have respect for, deep respect for Muslims. Or, no, for Islam or Muslims, you remember? It makes a difference.
Muslims is the proper term there, yes.
Yeah. Oh, well, you can respect the Muslim, but for Islam, I don't have any respect for it. Islam, per se. But anyway, I often hear the Catholic Church will say we all worship the same God, which is our God, is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Jacob's name was changed to Israel.
You only got about 10 seconds
okay.
here, Jerry.
But Catholics always clarify that they are Catholic first rather than Christians, so that might be an explanation there.
Well, I don't know. I don't think I've ever heard a Catholic say they're Catholics first rather than Christians. I would hope that if they really believe what they believe is true, they would say there's no distinction between the two. I wouldn't say I'm Lutheran first rather than a Christian or Christian first more than a Lutheran, because I equate the two as synonymous with one another. I do so proudly. And if Catholics really believe what they believe, they should do so proudly too. I think they're wrong, but they shouldn't apologize for being Catholic if they consider it synonymous with being Christian. When we come back, more of Audio Open Lines for your questions and your comments.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Every month, we tell you about our Issues, Etc. book of the month. Well, our book of the month for September isn't a book. It's an audio CD and a companion booklet. It's called Listening to Luther. On this audio CD, Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Ken Sherb narrates Luther's Small Catechism. This narration is accompanied by hymns that fit the theme of each part of the catechism. Listening to Luther is $14.99. You can find it at either of the two Concordia Publishing House bookstores, one at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. When you stop by, mention Issues, Etc., and ask for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for September, the audio CD, Listening to Luther. The two locations, 3558 South Jefferson, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Listening to Luther.
Death, is it really our ally?
Answers with Ken Ham, developer of a large creation museum near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, Ken, do some people really believe that death's our friend?
Well, it certainly sounds strange to me, especially when we attend funeral services of loved ones. But if you accept evolution, then death must be our ally in the creation of life. You know, the late evolutionist Carl Sagan described his view of death in these words, "The secrets of evolution are time and death." That's what he said. According to this view, death explains all the wonderful diversity of life on Earth. Death's always been a part of history. It's our ally. This has become the most widely accepted view of death today. But the book of Genesis gives a completely different view of death. Death is an enemy, as the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians. It's an intruder that has invaded our once perfect world. And the book of Revelation tells us death will one day be cast into the lake of fire. You know, Christians need to make sure they know who is their enemy. In fact, how can you fight a war if you can't even identify the enemy? Death is our enemy. According to Romans 3:23, death's the penalty for sin, and this fact's the foundation of the gospel. So you see, the whole message of the gospel and salvation in Christ depends upon the right view of death.
Ken Ham offers the answer to the question, why does a loving God allow death and suffering and terrorism in this world? Ken's insights are found in a booklet he wrote right after 9/11. For your free copy, go to AnswersRadio.com.
Todd Wilkin here, talking with Dr. Dean Wenthe, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Wenthe, tell us about Concordia Theological Seminary as a worldwide outreach.
We have, at latest count, about 23 different countries represented on our campus. We have a full-time staff member teaching in Lithuania, another in Siberia, and then our resident faculty teaches regularly in Kenya, in Haiti. We just recently received an invitation to teach in Madagascar. So our commitment is to be a light on the hill and to broadcast the light of Christ into all the world.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit them on the web at www.ctsfw.edu.
Do you want more of God's grace?
Village Lutheran Church in Ladue is a Bible-believing church faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community that cares, with a vibrant, historic Christian liturgy. Village Lutheran Church is located at 9237 Clayton Road in Ladue. www.villagelutheranchurch.org. Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, 314-993-1834.
I hope that my profound respect for world religions and for Muslims, who worship the one God, and with him we promote peace, liberty, social justice, and moral values for the benefit of all humanity, is clear.
Pope Benedict XVI, that was this morning, speaking at a mass in English, saying, if you didn't catch it, he actually did say yes, that all world religions, including Christianity and Islam, worship the one God, he said. I want to hear from you on what the Pope had to say and his latest remarks there on Islam. There's a new wrinkle. I wonder if that will make the Muslims happy. If they really believe what they say they believe, it will not. I can guarantee you. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in numbers for the last half hour of Audio Open Lines live this Wednesday here on Issues Etc., September the 20th. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You can email us here in the studio as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Tomorrow on the program, a tribute to the late Dr. Kurt Marquardt, some interviews recorded with him on the Athanasian Creed and the limits of science, and we'll also discuss the role of women in the church. Dr. Martin Noland will be on the program tomorrow. Friday, a two-hour discussion with Mark Galley of Christianity Today magazine on sentimental Christianity. You really want to listen to this one. This, as I said a couple days ago, this interview with Mark just exceeded expectations. And he has some real gems that if we had been ready to play Soundbite of the Week this week, we would have pulled them from that Galley interview on sentimental Christianity. Now, be sure to tell your friends at church on Sunday to tune in to our interview with Scott Klusendorf on stem cell research. It's coming up. this Sunday night live on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis from 10 to 11. We're going to discuss Amendment 2 here in Missouri, and we're going to have Scott react to the commercials by the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures. That's live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Katie's up first for this last half hour. Katie's calling from her car. Hi. Hi, Katie.
I've heard that Muslims will venerate Mary, kiss the emblem of Mary on rosaries if the crucifix is removed. And is this denying the deity of Christ essentially by saying we're all worshiping one God, not those treading forward towards the false prophet, possibly, apostate pope? I know a lot of people have speculated there. Wanted your feedback.
All right. Thank you, Katie. Well, okay, I don't know about Muslims venerating an image of Mary. I just find that difficult to... I'd have to see some evidence of it, because Muslims are pretty strict about this whole image thing. They're pretty serious about it. One of the things that offended them most about the cartoons that involved Muhammad of late was that there were images of the prophet himself. Now, do they highly regard the Virgin Mary? Yes, they do. Do they believe that Jesus was born of a virgin? Yes, they do. Do they believe that Jesus is the Son of God born of the Virgin Mary? No, they don't. They believe that he is a great prophet born of a virgin, a miraculous birth, but not conceived by the Holy Spirit and born of the Virgin Mary. It was simply, a miracle of Allah. He is not the Son of God. He is merely a prophet, and he is a lesser prophet than Muhammad himself. So, it's a little tricky. Also, someone had mentioned the Trinity before. One of the callers had mentioned the Trinity in the last segment. Dr. Schmidt has pointed out several times here on the program when we've talked about Islam that Muhammad was under the impression, because he had contact with heretical sectors of Christianity, he was under the impression that the Christian teaching on the Trinity was Father, Son, and Virgin Mary as three gods. That was Muhammad's impression of the Trinity, as recorded in the Quran. So he wasn't even really reacting to the true teaching of the Trinity as it is. Kia writes this from Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, what about Zoroastrians? Yes, Kia, what about them? With all this talk about the acceptable monotheists, we always leave out the Zoroastrians. It's just not fair, since all you need is to believe in one God. You're right. Zoroastrians are monotheists. Do you know what? There was also a form of monotheism in ancient Egypt for a very short amount of time. They must have worshipped the true God, too. Now, let's see, who else are monotheists? Oh, yes, there's an ancient form of Chinese monotheism. Very, very ancient. It doesn't exist anymore, but we find evidence of it in ancient Chinese history. They must have also been worshipping the same God as Christians. By the logic that is employed by those who say, hey, if you're a monotheist, it's all the same God, it's all good. Actually, I'd even press it one step further. The next time someone walks up to you and says, hey, Christians and Muslims and Jews, they all worship the same God. Aren't they all monotheists? Aren't they all descendants of Abraham in some sense? Don't they all hearken back to the Old Testament? Come on, it's all one variations on one big common theme, isn't it? If you're a monotheist, you must be worshiping the one true God. There actually have been people who've made this argument. Since you claim to worship one God, and there really is only one God, it has to be by default, the true God you're worshiping. Try this one on them if someone is foolish enough to say such a thing to you. Say, okay, try this one on for size. I am God. I am the one true God. I am the only God there is. Now, by the logic of, if it's a monotheist, it must be worshiping the true God, you would have to permit that I, too, who claim to be the one true God, am worshiping the same God as Christians. It just demonstrates how ridiculous the argument really is. Do you agree or disagree with me? Maybe you do disagree. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I mean, maybe my argument is a straw man and you've got a better one. I'd love to hear it. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's Audio Open Lines this Wednesday, the 20th of September. Ann's calling from Crestwood. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good afternoon. I was watching PBS News last evening, and there was a gentleman on who I guess was a Muslim diplomat or scholar or something along those lines, and he was saying that the Vatican used to have a Muslim scholar, but they had gotten rid of him. And in light of what has just happened, it certainly seems like they better get him back. And in addition to that, I was thinking, Todd, that you should send the Vatican your Issues, Etc. journal, because they certainly need to learn some good theology.
That's a nice compliment, Anne. Thank
it's
you very
true.
Much. Thank you. Look, it would be a smart idea to actually, if you're going to make statements about Islam at the level of, say, the Vatican or the Pope, it would be nice to actually check with thoroughgoing Muslims. It's not going to do you much good to have a westernized liberal Muslim theologian on your staff to tell you what Islam really teaches, because they're not going to tell you what Islam really teaches, or at least what the majority of Islam really teaches. But get yourself a real thoroughgoing Muslim to tell you when you say something foolish like, hey, don't we Christians and you Muslims worship the same God, for him to get dope slap you and say, no, you may think that, but we Muslims are smarter than that. Isn't that odd? The Muslims have to be the one to tell us, no, we don't worship the same God you do. Not even close. And Christians go, maybe we do. Maybe we deserve a dope slap. Charles is calling from St. Louis. Hi, Charles.
Hello, Todd. Just a couple things. I was wondering if I haven't heard all the press statements on Ahmadinejad. Is that pronounced correctly?
It's I got to look at my notes because I had to write it down myself. Yes,
yeah.
It's Ahmadinejad.
Ahmadinejad. Anyhow, I haven't heard the press's coverage on it today other than just a brief statement, but I would assume that there was not a lot of turmoil in their statements regarding his almost prayer, I would guess, plus his eschatology statements there that he made. But I was wondering if indeed President Bush would have done the same, there probably would have been a tremendous outcry. And I'm wondering why you would think that would be. That's just one thing. And secondly, on this Pope thing, if every time that Jesus was degraded or blasphemed in the world, man, Christians would be having a full-time job of writing. I just can't conceive of this whole thing. Secondly, I was wondering if you could tell me that, maybe you can comment on that, but I'm going to give you the second thing first. Previous guest book, I forgot what you said the title was.
Oh, Alvin Schmidt's book?
Yes.
It's called The Great Divide.
But then the subtitle?
Subtitle is The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, and you need to be careful because The Great Divide, I think, is a subject of the title of a couple other books, but it's called The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West.
Now, I wonder if that subtitle, in your opinion, I haven't read the book, if that subtitle, Todd, is the premise of the book, that indeed there will be a failure of Islam and a triumph of the West. Is that what the premise is of the entire book?
He's not making any predictions in the book. What he's doing is, Dr. Schmidt is a sociologist who is a consummate researcher, especially of history. And what he does in the book is simply outline where Christianity has set its foot by way of influence, what it has wrought, what kind of societies it has wrought, as opposed to where Islam has set its foot by way of influence, what kind of societies has it produced. And he's speaking there historically and not making any predictions about the success or failure of Islam.
He's not, okay.
No.
Well, why was that subtitle label as such, you think?
No, it's a good question, and thank you. I'm going to address all your issues here, Charles. He's the reason it's subtitled that we could have to ask Dr. Schmidt, but I think it is saying, historically, has Islam succeeded in the promise that it constantly makes? Here's the president of Iran saying, if you just let it, if the world was more like Iran, we'd have justice and peace. Well, look at Iran. Let's objectively measure if it's produced what it's promised. And his thesis is, in The Great Divide, Dr. Schmidt's is, that it has failed, and failed miserably, by way of the kind of societies it produces. Okay, let's deal with Charles' points that he raises here. If Bush would have prayed at the end of his address, actually I think that Ahmadinejad prayed several times during his address. I had a chance to look over the text of his full address, which deviated significantly from what he actually said in the UN chamber. But If Bush would have prayed at the end of his UN address, it certainly would have been viewed as a slap in the face to the worldwide community, as a terribly insensitive and intolerant thing to do. Not because he's Bush, because he would have, if he's the Christian he says he is, he would have prayed a Christian prayer. If Bush would have waxed eloquent about any possible apocalyptic view he has, his dispensational ideas, I don't know that he holds any, but let's say he did, and he would have waxed eloquent about the rise of the Antichrist, the return of Christ to come and establish justice in the earth, there'd be nothing else we'd be talking about. It would have pushed all news. It would have made the Pope's comments look like nothing. You're right. But it's not because he's Bush. It's because of all the ideas that can be tolerated in a pluralistic religious society and world, the one that can't are the exclusive claims of Christianity. Now, you said Christians reacted the way Muslims did to the denigration of Christ in the public square, you're right there, Charles. We would not be able to keep up with it. We'd just be protesting all day long. But that's not why Christians don't protest. We don't protest because we don't have the time. We don't protest because we understand it goes with the territory. Jesus says, they hate me. The world hates me. It will hate you. Deal with it. This is what you get when you were united with me in my death and resurrection. You're going to get a life that looks a lot like my life, my death, and my resurrection. And Christians rejoice to be thus united with Christ, even in suffering. Okay, we still have time for one more audio cut here during Audio Open Lines. It's an NBC Today show interview between Lester Holt and a Baptist pastor who conducts seminars on hot Christian sex.
You may not think the terms Christian conservative and steamy sex go together, but you might change your mind in the next few minutes. In a new web series called America Unzipped, MSNBC.com introduces us to one man who is trying to give sex a higher calling.
Now, most of the women in America, not all, but most of the women in America can be multi-orgasmic, even if they have not been to date.
This is Joe Beam, and these are conservative churchgoers. At first glance, you might wonder why this former Southern preacher can get away with talking like this in a church.
Number one answer, universally, how long does it take a man to be ready for sex? Now, it can vary with age. As he gets older, it can be.
But it's an audience of eager couples who want Bible-based advice about sex. Here he speaks about the Song of Solomon.
It's really a book about making love. It's about Solomon and his wife, and he's making love to this wife.
His audiences can be shy at first, but after the initial shock, a sex talk in church seems perfectly natural.
You may be thinking to yourself, is it ever true that a woman can be instantly ready for sex? The answer is yes. But don't worry about it, because it ain't never going to happen to you. All right, now,
Joe Beam is the head of Family Dynamics, and Brian Alexander is MSNBC.com sexploration columnist who profiled Joe for the web series American Unzipped. America Unzipped, and good morning to both. Thanks for being here. We should note, and that pretty much set it up, this is going to be a grown-up conversation. So
yes,
if you're offended by that sort of thing, you may want to look away for the next few moments. But let's talk about it. First of all, Joe, are Christians, are conservative or fundamentalist Christians, whatever you want to call them, sexually inhibited? And if so, are they only reading the parts of the Bible that talks about sexual immorality?
I think yes to both of those things. Yes, there are a lot of inhibitions. People don't do what they want to do, and so one's mad because the other one won't do it, or they both do it and wind up really frustrated because they feel guilty and think they're going to hell.
Who are you talking to in these seminars? I mean, you're reaching into the Bible to make these cases. Are you talking only to married couples, to committed couples, to straight couples? Who's the message for?
Well, I talk primarily to married couples.
Is that who you want to have the message?
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. That's my goal.
All right. I want to play a little bit more about one of your seminars and then talk about the graphic nature of what you talk about and why you use that method. Here we go.
How many of you gentlemen would find it erotic if your wife were to be guiding you on what she wanted you to do next to her body? Like, how many of you guys would find that erotic? Women, would you look around?
Why do you have to be so explicit?
Well, It was a Christian book that came out a few years ago where that they were talking about sex, and the author actually referred to a part of the male anatomy as Mr. Happy. I think that if we're going to be talking about this and taking it seriously, we can't talk about it like children. We have to just talk about it like it really is.
Yeah, and popular culture, something a lot of Christians reject, is telling us that hot sex is good all the time. Mm-hmm. But they reject that. But when it comes from you, we see people laughing, smiling, and I'm going to get Brian's take on this in a moment. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, because of the fact that finally some Christian authority is telling them this is okay. You can actually make love to each other and have fun in the process of doing it. And it gives a sense of freedom.
All right. And Brian, you have been to these sessions. Right. You've talked to people. What's the sense? Has some veil been lifted off them after these seminars?
It's actually quite striking what happens to people. Joe talks, people laugh a lot. There's a lot of sort of husbands poking wives in the ribs and vice versa. And by the end of the day, there is a sense of relief, almost like a collective sigh. Because either they were doing it and feeling miserable about it or not doing it, and as Joe says, feeling frustrated.
He's kind of given them a license now.
He's given them permission.
To deal with this. You reach for into Scripture.
Right.
To say this is a healthy and a normal and important part of marriage. Right. Do you draw lines, though? Things that no. That's not permissible.
Well, basically three. One is it can't involve anybody you're not married to. Secondly, it can't involve any animal. And thirdly, it can't do anything that hurts the other person. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I think those are the scriptural boundaries.
But we should note you're coming from one sect of Christianity. This runs contrary to, for example, what the Catholic Church teaches. Mm-hmm. You have also run afoul of some in the conservative Christian movement.
Yes.
And I should ask Brian about that. What's your sense as to how this is received among greater Christianity?
Yeah, there's absolutely great division within Christianity about, for example, masturbation. I mean, it's almost like a 50-50 split. Some people condemn masturbation. Joe and other people don't condemn masturbation. Yet masturbation is a very natural part of human life.
Not a word we use on this show a lot, but
he did it.
Apparently it is now.
All right, there's a story from NBC's Today Show. you know, we live in an era of all service and full service churches where, as I said yesterday, you go to church and you expect to have your oil change free while you listen to the sermon. Your kids watched and entertained. You expect to be entertained. You expect to be able to bring your big gulp in and have a cup holder right there in the, well, they're not pews anymore, the theater and stadium style seating. We expect the church to cater to our every whim, our every need, our every desire, and every possible predicament we might find ourselves in everyday life. We expect a church to have some answer for it. It's a full-service church mentality. Is this going too far? I want to hear from you. We've only got a few minutes left here in audio open lines. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. To say, look, if the church provides for your every possible whim, need, desire, or predicament, and there's some sort of answer in the Bible to everything, well, why not go to the Song of Solomon and find there a prescription for hot and steamy sex. Oh, by the way, I have to respond to that, if nothing else. The Song of Solomon is not about hot, steamy sex. It's about Christ and his church. Pastor Beam's reading of the Song of Solomon would require me to read that book as though there's nothing of Jesus Christ in it. And I'm sorry, you just can't do that. Is it about a passionate love relationship between Christ and his church? Yeah, far more passionate than any husband could have for his wife. But it's about Christ and his church. All right. Why does everything that Christians do have to be better? Why does the church say, look, you become a Christian and it will be better. It, whatever it is, will be better. Sex, food, money, kids, the dog. You know, we see these billboards. I've talked about them before. Out there in suburbia, there are billboards for big suburban churches, and it might as well be an advertisement for a country club. There's the good-looking husband who's still good-looking and getting better-looking because men get better-looking with age, and his wife, she's nice-looking too. Not a gray hair in sight. They're wearing beautiful clothes. They could have just walked right out of a J. Crew catalog. The kids, well-groomed, smiling, in the proper number, 2.5 of them. There's the dog, and the dog has just been brushed. No drool, wagging his tail. Everyone, including the dog, has pearly white teeth and shining eyes. And it's an advertisement for a church. It's selling Christianity as a lifestyle, the better lifestyle. the good life, the fulfillment of the American dream. Why is it that everything has to be great, including the sex? Look, I got no problem with great sex. Don't get me wrong. But more often than not, in my experience, it's an accident. Everything, why does everything have to be better for Christians? Whatever became of, you know what? We have heard Jesus say, come and follow me. And by the way, I promise you better sex. No, he would have said, come and follow me. And when you follow me, you'll give up far more than you gain in this world. And you might even lose that beautiful blonde-haired, no gray hair wife of yours. In fact, you're going to have to love me more than her if you really want to be my disciple. Oh, no, by the way, you might also have to die like me. He doesn't promise us good or great sex. How did the church survive for 2,000 years without sex seminars? How did it survive for 2,000 years without biblical prescriptions for great sex, steamy sex? We should expect it. We're Christians, after all. We're God-chosen people. You know what? Here's a quote from one of the things that goes with this. Bean sees an attitude every day. Women tell him, I feel like I'm sinning when I make love to my husband. And so his response is, sex is a gift of God. Therefore, whatever you do in the marriage bed, as long as it doesn't involve an animal or harming someone, isn't a sin. Well, is sex sinful? No. Not within marriage. It is not sinful. But if you're out there thinking that being a Christian will give you sinless sex, you're fooling yourself. I think this is what really drives it. People who say, I feel a little guilty having sex. It seems a little dirty to me. And I want to have sinless sex. I want guilt-free sex. You know what? We live in a fallen world. We are fallen people. Whether it's sex or food or sports or work or church or sleep, or anything else we do, it's all stained by sin. We are sinners in need of repentance and forgiveness, whether it is enjoying the good gift of sex, the good gift of food, or of church, or of our children, or of work, or of sleep. There isn't a sinless anything in this world except Jesus Christ. You're looking for sinlessness. You don't look for it by the steamy Song of Solomon sex that is pushed by this Baptist pastor. If you want something sinless, cling to the sinless life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And then, in Christian freedom, you can actually enjoy, and sometimes you won't always so much enjoy, the good gift of sex. You know what? It's still a good gift, even if it isn't hot and steamy. It's still a good gift, even if you walk away saying, well, okay, that rates a 5 instead of a 10. It's still God's good gift, even if you don't enjoy it to its fullest each and every time. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., a tribute to the late Dr. Kurt Marquardt. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.